Well, good evening, everybody. Let me welcome you all here this evening. This lecture is part of the Miliband program established in memory of Ralph Miliband. Ralph Miliband, as everyone here will know, was one of the most famous political thinkers of the post-war period and was for many years a stalwart of the LSE. And David Harvey, together with Perry Anderson, is a Miliband fellow at the LSE, and very pleased we are to have him here. Let me just say a few brief things about David Harvey's career, very brief, since I introduced him last year in a very similar setting. He's routinely revealed, I think, as perhaps the top geographer, certainly right up there, in citation indices, which I checked recently. He's one of a really interesting group of people we have at the LSE at the moment, whose work concentrates around cities, urbanism, a range of issues, which is drawing together, I think, fruitfully, a lot of people in the LSE. So he's a very prominent figure in that. He's Professor of Geography at Johns Hopkins University. He was previously Professor of Geography at Oxford University from 1987 to 1993. Among his books are an early famous one, Social Justice in the City, Limits of Capital, very famous one called The Condition of Postmodernity, and many others. He has lots of awards, including the Outstanding Contributor Award to the Association of American Geographers, and various gold medals, which I won't read out in any detail, but which certainly sound to me extremely impressive. I'm asked to announce that there'll be a triple book launch on Monday the 13th of March, of which David's new book will be one of the books there. This is called Spaces of Hope, and I think it's just about coming out now. I've certainly seen a physical copy of it very recently. Ed Soger's book, seen down the front row there, called Post-Metropolis, and Saskia Sassen's book, sitting down the front row on the right, called Guests and Aliens. All this formidable battery of works will be launched in A58, which is just along the corridor there, Monday 13th of March. So I'd encourage anyone who's interested in the debates around these works to come to that book launch. In the meantime, let me again welcome David Harvey. The title of his lecture this evening is Cosmopolitanism and the Banality of Geographical Evils. Very pleased to welcome David Harvey.
I want to offer some observations on this word, cosmopolitanism, which has undergone a considerable revival over the last few years. The interesting thing about this revival is that the word seems to have lost many of its negative connotations, which earlier in the last century usually lumped together cosmopolitans, Jews, communists, as people who are antagonistic to social bonding and national solidarities and therefore deserve to be given the treatment. So its revival has lost that negative side, but it's still controversial. It's controversial in the sense that there's a lot of debate over whether it means anything at all and whether it's worth using, and if so, how should it be worth using? And it is that debate that I want to spend a little time sort of reflecting on tonight. Now, the reason the term has come back, and I think this is important to acknowledge, is that there's an obvious association between the word cosmopolitanism and the idea of globalization. And in a sense, it seems to me that much of the discussion about cosmopolitanism in the work of people like David Held or Ulrich Beck here earlier this term is really trying to find a moral and ethical compass in the midst of all of this neoliberal global activity. And again, from this standpoint, I think we have to acknowledge that the rise of this new word signifies something important. The importance, however, depends on how you interpret it. And in the discussions and debates which I've read, it seems that everybody wants to put something in front of the word. They want to hyphenate it in some way or other. So that after a while, people say, well, cosmopolitanism in itself doesn't make sense. You have to put something in front of it. Sort of socialist cosmopolitanism, or feminist cosmopolitanism, or environmental. You can sort of go on and add to the list, and then you get some very peculiar ones, like rooted cosmopolitanism, vernacular cosmopolitanism. And out of this, there comes what those we academics love, which is a tremendous debate, a whole new theory, if you like, a whole new business, which is called cosmopolitics, which is going to keep us quiet for the next 20 years in the same way that globalization sort of regularly keeps us quiet, as it has done over the last few years. So let me then start with a peculiar sidebar on this question and then try to shift it so that it becomes a little bit more fundamental. And the sidebar I want to start with is a citation I came across in Martha Nussbaum, who's one of the leading figures in promoting the cosmopolitan ethic. And in her article, which sparked a lot of the discussion in the United States, she kind of complained in the middle of it that there was an incredible lack of knowledge of the rest of the world on the part of Americans, and that they needed to know more about the world in order to better understand themselves. And she then went on to observe, to conduct this sort of global dialogue, we need knowledge not only of the geography and ecology of other nations, and then she says, something that would already entail much revision in our curricula, but also a great deal about their people, so that in talking with them, we may be capable of respecting their traditions and commitments. Cosmopolitan education would supply the background necessary for this type of deliberation. Now, one of the hats I wear is that of geographer, and what she's asking for here then is a revision in our curricula in geography and in anthropology in order to better found and ground our cosmopolitan thinking. And it was on this point that I suddenly thought to myself, well, here's an interesting line of argument. What kind of geographical knowledge would you need in order to be able to make cosmopolitan arguments in a way that makes sense or is useful in some specific political way? And on this point, I noted that nearly everybody who writes about cosmopolitanism goes back to certain founding figures. The Stoics are much brought into discussion. But the other figure, of course, is Immanuel Kant. And it's very hard to go very far in any of that discussion without finding Kant and Kant's essays on cosmopolitanism and history and universal peace being sort of trotted out and cited as exemplary statements over what cosmopolitanism is supposed to be about. Now, it so happens that as an undergraduate, which is, you can tell, rather a long time ago, I learned something about Kant, which is that Kant had actually taught geography, and that Kant had some significant things to say about geography. And over the years, since I can't read German and Kant's geography is not translated into English, I've sort of been a little curious about what Kant had to say or whether it was any significance. And over the years, I've had the pleasure of talking sometimes with various philosophers and theorists and people who are very familiar with Kant, and I invariably at some point rather slid into the conversation, so sort of rather timidly, since I'm a geographer, you know, and we all have that terrible inferiority complex. Kant taught some geography. Is there anything interesting there? And they all said, oh, no. Oh, it's totally uninteresting. Not worthwhile bothering with, has no significance whatsoever. And so, you know, I generally retired into my corner, as we geographers do on these occasions, licking our wounds and saying, well, I guess even Kant couldn't say anything significant about what we do. Well, it so happened at almost exactly this time last year, I happened to be in Paris, and I went into a Paris bookstore, and right in front of me was a new French translation of Kant's geography. Now, I can't read German, but I can sort of stumble through French. So I thought, oh, this is interesting. I'll pick this up and read it. And I picked it up, and I took it down to my favorite cafe, and I sort of was going through it. And I'm not surprised all those philosophers said the things they said about it, because it's the biggest pile of gibberish and anecdotal rubbish you've ever come across in your whole goddamn life. And you're saying to yourself, how can somebody like Kant write this kind of stuff? Where is his systematic ideas gone? What's wrong with him that he can't handle this material? And it's even worse than that. It's not only this unsystematic and therefore totally unscientific and totally sort of garbled, it also contains statements like this. In hot countries, men mature more quickly in every respect, but they do not attain the perfection of the temperate zones. Humanity achieves its greatest perfection with the white race. The yellow Indians have somewhat less talent. The Negroes are much inferior, and some of the peoples of the Americas are well below them. All inhabitants of hot lands are exceptionally lazy. They're also timid, and the same two traits characterize also folk living in the far north. Timidity engenders superstition, and in lands ruled by kings leads to slavery. Ostoyaks, Samoyeds, Lapps, Greenlanders, etc., resemble people of hot lands in their timidity, laziness, superstition, and desire for strong drink, but lack the jealousy characteristic of the latter, since their climate does not stimulate their passions greatly. Too little and also too much perspiration makes the blood thick and viscous. In mountain lands, men are persevering, merry, brave, lovers of freedom and of their country, etc., etc. Burmese women wear indecent clothing and take pride in getting pregnant by Europeans. The Hottentots are dirty and you can smell them from far away. The Javanese are thieving, conniving, and servile, sometimes full of rage and at other times craven with fear. It goes on and on and on like this. And when you actually pick up Kant's anthropology, you find it's full of the same stuff. So not only is it unsystematic all over the place, it's also highly prejudicial stuff. So no wonder the philosophers didn't want to deal with it. It's embarrassing. It's also politically incorrect and all the rest of it, you know. But then it says, you say, well, okay, maybe there's some excuse for Kant on all of this. He's just repeating many of the ideas that were handed over to him by Montesquieu, Buffon, and, you know, anybody who came down the pike. Maybe the problem with his geography was that he never left Königsberg. Maybe the problem is that he, you know, he never actually prepared this material for publication. And what's come down to us are just his lecture notes plus some notes which were appended by some of his main students. So maybe it really was just a sort of sidebar on what he was doing and therefore quite irrelevant. But it turns out that's a little bit hard to sustain. To begin with, Kant had to challenge university authorities and get very special permission in order to teach the geography. Secondly, he taught the course 49 times in his life. And after logic and metaphysics, it was the second most important course he taught. Now, I'm very committed to Marx's Capital, and I've taught it something like 39 times in my life. And you can't teach something 39 times in your life without thinking there's something serious about it. So Kant actually thought the geography was significant in some way or other. Also, when you start to go through his other works and start to look at, and this has been reconstructed by a man called May, when you start to look, you find that he starts to say at various points that geography and anthropology are significant forms of knowledge. They are the essential prerequisite, the condition of possibility of all forms of knowledge. And they're the condition of possibility of the application of all forms of knowledge. Now you can see immediately the kind of conundrum to which this leads. You have his universal ethics, his cosmopolitanism, and his cosmopolitan principles. But then you project them into this geographical world of differentiation that he's talking about, and what do you get? Well, either, you know, the Hottentots have to learn to wash, and the Burmese women have to learn to dress properly. In other words, you flatten out all geographical differences, in which case the universal ethic can reasonably be well applied, or else the universal ethic operates as an intensely discriminatory code upon a geographically differentiated world. And as such, you end up not being cosmopolitan in the sense of being ethically good, you end up being cosmopolitan in the sense that you apply it in this highly discriminatory sort of way. Now, these are very real problems right today. For instance, in this very theater, I heard Ulrich Beck say last year that he'd been talking about, or listening to people talking about, the notion of the European Union as Kant's dream of a cosmopolitan republicanism realized. I then see Ulrich Beck quoted in the New York Times later on about the bombing of Serbia and what's going on in Kosovo, saying this is NATO's new military humanism. Now, you can see immediately that much of the rhetoric that was built around that particular political event was about morality and goodness being applied in a very specific geographical kind of way with all kinds of intensely discriminatory results. So I think the Kantian dilemma is not, as it were, something that existed merely back then. It exists today. And it exists because also my own impression of undergraduates at Johns Hopkins University, it's a fairly elite university, and even listening to some of my colleagues in the engineering school, is that actually the state of geographical knowledge of the world is not much better than the one which is in Kant's geography. The sort of casual conversations you hear are similarly prejudicial, are similarly casual, are similarly anecdotic. And very often you find people who've never even heard of a particular place say, yes, we should go there and bomb them because there are evil people there. You know, Gaddafi, Hussein, whoever, you know, go bomb them because they're evil. Now, this particular problem has, however, a deeper resonance. And I'm going to take a detour at this point, or a seeming detour. Because at the same time I was reading Kant's geography as I was sort of ambling around in Paris, it so happened that I was doing the proofs of the last book, and somebody had made a comment that I had said something unfortunate about Foucault and that I should correct it, and that the way I should correct it was I should go back and I should read The Order of Things. So I actually found myself, one of these peculiar happenstances in life, of sitting in this cafe with Kant, geography in one hand and The Order of Things in my pocket on the other, and pretty soon The Order of the Things popped out as being connected to Kant's geography. Because if you remember The Order of Things, it opens with Foucault talking about his immense hilarity, his uncontrollable laughter, when he reads a Borges story, which starts with a sort of Chinese dictionary of animals, which is a dog painted with a camel hair brush, the cat that's just thrown up in the gutter, I mean, it's just all kinds of things like that, sort of strung together. And Foucault reads this and is immensely amused and then goes on to derive from it the notion of what he calls the heteroclite, that is, things which just absolutely cannot be related to each other. They're so radically, they're so different that there's no connection. And the heteroclite generates a notion of heterotopia, which is spaces of otherness, of difference, of which cannot, as it were, be absorbed into the general structures of power and belonging. And that concept of heterotopia is then seen as disruptive of universal meaning, disruptive of universal ethics. Now, I think there's a minor tragedy here, and the minor tragedy is that Foucault used Borges. He should have used Kant. He should have used Kant's geography. Because if he'd used Kant's geography, he would have seen something which was, I think, much more significant and much more important. And it is not as if Foucault didn't know Kant's geography, because Foucault translated Kant's anthropology into French. So that Foucault knew it very well. But he chose, as it were, to laugh at Borges instead of the incoherence of Kant's geography. Now, what Foucault does then with this notion of heterotopia is something interesting, because later on he's talking to architects and planners and he launches this kind of idea about heterotopia as a version of spatiality of a different kind, spatialities of otherness that can somehow or other be constructed or thought about and so on. And he relates a whole set of things about heterotopias as being, as it were, a liberatory idea that can be projected into oppressive conversations and oppressive conceptual apparatuses. The only trouble is that when he starts to talk in concrete terms about this liberatory spaces, he mentions all sorts of peculiar spaces. He says, you know, things like cemeteries, brothels, colonies, the post-colonials, I don't know what you make of that, but the colonies, and prisons. And at some point or other, he even goes so far as to say, you know, heterotopia is really all about boats. You know, it's all about having a boat that can sail somewhere, and societies that don't have boats, they just can't do anything. So he has this wonderful phrase, if I can retrieve my paper off the floor here. He has this wonderful phrase where he says, in civilizations without boats, dreams dry up, espionage takes the place of adventure, and police take the place of pirates. Now, my comment on that is, I keep on expecting that to be used as an ad for a Caribbean cruise. And this, at this point, you suddenly see, well, this concept of heterotopia is not going anywhere. Any space can be described as heterotopic. It can be anything. It could be the militia movement in the Michigan woods. It can be Jonestown. It can be the shopping mall. And in fact, you find a lot of Foucauldians sort of taking it in that kind of direction. Every space is a heterotopic space, and therefore the thing becomes, as it were, almost as banal as Kant's geography. So here we have then this problem. And Foucault's arguments here have also an eerie parallel with those of Kant. Foucault never revised the text on heterotopia for publication. It remained unpublished. Just before his death, he gave permission for it to be published. So he senses something important there in this notion, but he doesn't go back to it. He doesn't actually return to it and sort of really thoroughly, carefully try to work it out. That is, he seems like he's almost blocked on it. In exactly the same way, in the introduction to the French version of the Anthropology, he looks at the Anthropology and says there's a very serious project here as to how anthropological knowledge is going to be incorporated into philosophical understandings. But he never returns to that one either. So it's like the two conditionalities, anthropology and geography of knowledge, he sort of recognizes tangentially and then backs away from. And when he's interviewed by a bunch of geographers for the radical geography journal Erudot, they try and ask him all kinds of tangible questions about real geographical things and so on. Foucault gives all these incredibly evasive answers, from which, if you're a sort of a philosopher, you can conclude that the geographers were just being stupid, but actually they were asking fairly sensible kinds of questions. But he just didn't want to answer them. He didn't want to deal with them. And then right at the end, he makes this quite extraordinary sort of statement. He says, I have enjoyed this discussion with you because I've changed my mind since we started. Now I can see that the problems you put to me about geography are crucial ones for me. Geography acted as the support, the condition of possibility. This is exactly Kant. The condition of possibility for the passage between a series of factors I tried to relate. Where geography itself was concerned, I either left the question hanging or established a series of arbitrary connections. Geography must indeed necessarily lie at the heart of my concerns. Now, in exactly the same way that when I've raised the question of Kant's geography with philosophers, they all kind of go, "Ah, it's not interesting, it's boring, I'm not excited about that." If you raise this with many of the people in the Foucault camp, they kind of say, oh, well, he was just tired of talking to those pesky geographers. He wanted them to get off his back, you know, so he was a way of shutting them up and moving on to more important things. But I really think that's an erroneous way to look at it. And here's why. Because unless you can take a general philosophical argument of some sort and throw it into the tangible conditions of anthropological and geographical differentiation, then you're always going to be back into this kind of business of doing an injustice to those forms of difference. This then posed a problem or an interesting idea which I've been batting around for some considerable time now. And that's the idea that when you insert geographical understandings, and I'm mainly going to talk about the geographical, but the anthropological ones move parallel with this. When you project geographical understandings into general theoretical works, there is an incredibly disruptive effect which occurs upon those general theoretical works. And this is as true of Marx and Marxism as it is of anything else. And that disruptive effect produces a dual reaction. One is to deny that geography has any significance whatsoever and say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter. It's irrelevant. It's unimportant. Or the other reaction is to kind of say, well, yeah, you may be right, but it's really simply about the application of the principles, and therefore the principles can be elaborated upon without considering the spatiality or the geography of conditions where they are applied. Now, on this front, I would like to use just one example, and it's an example that occurred many, many years ago, back in 1957, when in an article in Econometrica, two economists, Koopmans and Beckman, wrote an article, and it was a simple article about a location allocation problem. And in the midst of this, they ended up kind of saying, you know, the difficulty with this is as soon as you actually put the locational problem into the center of what we're doing, you can't get equilibrium prices. Now, if you take away the notion of equilibrium price for much of economic theory, then that economic theory doesn't work too well. In fact, it doesn't work well at all. And Koopmans and Beckman actually said at the end of their piece, they said, you know, we were so disturbed by this finding that we delayed publication of it for many, many years. But we felt, in the end, we had to publish it. And of course, it's published, it sits there. Nobody knows much what to do with it, except the economists then decide they don't have to deal with space anymore because it's too problematic, too difficult, so they can construct a spatial theory. Though, of course, that is beginning to change now. We'll get back to that in a minute. Now, this idea then says, how do we handle the problem of geographical spatial dynamics in political theory, economic theory, any kind of sociological theory? And all of these theoretical apparatuses run into this sort of blockage when they hit this specific kind of problem. And recently, of course, that blockage has been very helpful. One of the reasons why I think postmodernism has made so much of spatiality is because it wished to deny the power of universality and generality and meta-narratives and all the rest of it. And since space was disruptive of that, then you introduce space and then it disrupts it all and then fine. So the postmodern disruption, insofar as postmodernism has been about disruption, which quite a bit of it has, then spatiality becomes a very convenient metaphor to play with the disruption, and that therefore explains why the heterotopia, why order of things, all those kinds of things get into the game. And I started to think, well, okay, I must look at this, how this works in political theory. And I went off and read a whole bunch of political theorists talking about these kinds of problems. And almost every one of them kind of recognizes that there's a problem about spatiality in terms of, say, democracy and devolution and all those sorts of questions. There's a problem here, a sort of kind of geographical problem. But almost all of the writing does something very peculiar. Instead of going off and saying, okay, so what is geographical knowledge really all about? What is geographical knowledge going to contribute? They all go off and they read Foucault or Deleuze or Derrida or something like that, you know, and get out of it that way. In other words, they trot out what I call the usual suspects in order to get themselves out of a dilemma. And this actually even occurs the other way around. And I've come across a whole series of articles recently, one by Deshpande and another one by Azoulay, for example, where they're talking about, and this is an anthropologist, Deshpande, an anthropologist, talking about many of the problems of intercommunal reorganization and violence in India and the origins of a lot of that. And it's a very interesting sort of piece. And he's recognizing that the whole kind of spatial structure and the geography of it is something which is very, very significant. To understand the geography Nehru's developmentalism versus the geography of Hindu nationalism, all those sorts of questions. Those things have to be brought into the picture, and he's doing really interesting stuff on that until he says, well, you know, there's a way out of understanding all of this. What is the way? Well, actually, somebody suggested I go off and read Foucault. So he goes off and he reads Foucault. And he has a very interesting phrase about a lot of the way in which Hindu reorganization has occurred in India. He talks about what he calls the sedimented banalities of neighborliness, in which he's really kind of saying the problem that we're not able to grapple with is the simple notion of local identifications and the way in which those local identifications could be mobilized in terms of grander political projects. A similar article, essay by somebody called Azoulay about the whole kind of dilemmas of Palestinian and Israeli occupation in Jerusalem. Similarly, was doing fine until it sort of went into the sort of Foucault trendiness and kind of got lost in sort of, well, what does heterotopia really mean in all of this kind of thing. So what is happening here is that, in effect, a banal concept of heterotopia is being set up as a theoretical construct to try to explain the banalities that come out of sedimented neighborliness. Now, this is not, again, a problem that is far, far away. I mean, what if, for example, the whole project of New Labour comes crashing down on the very simple problem of local identifications and the geographical dynamics of devolution? Wouldn't that be amusing? Not brought down by some massive attack from the left, you know, but just simply brought down by something as simple as that. And a failure to recognize the simplicity of that. So where then are we able to go with this particular kind of dilemma? What kind of geographical knowledge would be required for what kind of cosmopolitan project? And here it seems to me there is a broad question which needs to be set up, which is as applicable to Marxism as it is to anything else. After all, in its own way, Marxism has always been a cosmopolitan kind of project. It's an internationalist project, cosmopolitan project, and it's not been very good about understanding the geographical environments into which it's projected itself. It's not really been very good at understanding the anthropological, geographical conditions under which that Marxist project could operate. So that here too there is a problem of the nature of the geographical knowledges that might be inserted into different kinds of international, political, cosmopolitan projects. And this leads to a little bit of a reflection on the nature of geographical knowledges, and I'm going to give you sort of a brief potted history of this. And I want to segment it into two. Firstly, by thinking about geography as a sort of almost a professional kind of knowledge. What has it been about as a discipline? And where is it lain within the intellectual division of labor? The way I would look at this is to say, let's do a contrast between two people who quite literally sat at Kant's feet and studied with Kant and drew a great deal from Kant. And they were the brothers Humboldt. Wilhelm became a very important philologist, philosopher, and founded the University of Berlin and became an absolutely critical person in relationship to the foundation of the University of Berlin. And his cosmopolitanism was of that abstract ethical kind, you know, the kind that fits into the sort of that initial sort of notion of Kantianism. But you'll notice this evolution in the University of Berlin itself, that it became absorbed into a kind of ethnic identification project. So that the cosmopolitanism became, as it were, part of national identity formation. So that was Wilhelm. And in the process, of course, disciplines were set up and disciplines were brought together around the notion of trying to identify and create the notion of a German identity. So the disciplines were arranged around this notion. The other brother, Alexander, didn't go for that at all. The other brother was actually taken with Kant's geography, and understanding that Kant was a bit remiss in never really leaving Königsberg, decided to travel around the world and to try to write his own geography, and try to write a very synthetic, systematic geography. And this he did. And he ended up writing a fantastic book called Cosmos. And I want to stress a little bit this notion of the relationship between cosmos and cosmopolitanism. Because what Humboldt did, what Alexander did, was to do something very special, that is to try to systematize geographical knowledge in certain kinds of ways so that it was usable in relationship to a variety of political projects. Now, the political project he was engaged in was, of course, Eurocentric. He was connected to his sponsors, i.e. the King of Spain, who wanted to know where the gold mines were and how to, you know, all those kinds of things. So, you know, the usual kinds of problems you could throw at Alexander of that sort. And he's interested in labor supplies and the like. So the usual kinds of problems of that sort. But nevertheless, he's advancing the arguments around geography in a way that actually takes off from Kant's geography and says, look, there is something we can do with this. There's something much more significant we can do with this. But Wilhelm never got a university position. Sorry, Alexander never got a university position. His kind of geography sort of ended up being stuck in a sort of extra world, mainly in Paris, and until he was thrown out of Paris in 1848 in the revolutions as a subversive, he was never in a position to really sort of insert his arguments into the main corpus of thinking in university situations. And part of the result of that is that geographical knowledge as a discipline, which once upon a time was central to almost everything. I mean, some of the major mathematicians, Gauss, Mercator, Euler, and so on, were actually caught up in geographical problems. So during that period of the Renaissance, everybody was a geographer. And geographical knowledge was everywhere and was understood to be everywhere. But then the discipline itself kind of got sidelined into this peculiar situation where it got squeezed between sociology and between anthropology and history and all the rest of it, and got sort of a few minor tasks to do, like go off and map things and do GIS and things like that. So it was reduced to a relatively minor kind of discipline. So that the positionality of geography as a discipline has not been conducive to finding answers to that kind of major question of what kind of geographical knowledge is going to be proper for what kind of cosmopolitan project. But geographical knowledges, and I'm going to use the plural now, have the habit of bursting out all over the place. You can find them everywhere. And it is very interesting, therefore, to look at the nature of geographical knowledges and where they reside. And one of the places they reside is, of course, within the state apparatus. For instance, just to take the United States, one of the key places where you'll find a lot of geographical knowledge, some of it sadly rather erroneous, is in the CIA, in the State Department, the Department of Defense. And actually, one of the places where geography is firmly implanted within the curricula is in all the military academies in the United States. Because geographical knowledge is there seen as absolutely fundamental to military strategy and also to geopolitical strategy. And at this point, you see that there's a capacity to construct geographical knowledges from a very specific kind of perception, very specific positionality. And it is, of course, a positionality of US interests. And in this case, US interests are not necessarily about really understanding how the rest of the world is or being benevolent towards the rest of the world, but trying, as it were, to create a global market. Much of globalization is something that's been forced by US policy over the last 50 years. To create a global market, to create an open field for the terrain of capital accumulation, to do all of those things that are absolutely central to the survival of the most dynamic of the capitalist systems in the world. And this becomes then, as it were, part of US geopolitical project. And geographical knowledge gets assembled around that project. And if you start to see how it gets assembled, there is, as it were, almost, if you want to put it in a conspiracy theory, it almost seems like there's an interest in keeping everybody in the nation ignorant of anything about matters geographical or anthropological, in order that when you really want to go do something in some part of the world, you can construct an almost instantaneous image of what is going on in those spaces, which needs to be, quote, corrected. Because the United States, believe it or not, has an intense notion that it is the moral guardian of much of the world. It is, as it were, the central ethical force in the world. It is a force for goodness, enlightenment, reason, and all the rest of it. And, you know, you can cynically dismiss it as if somehow or other, oh, well, that's just the Americans talking, but they deeply believe it. As does indeed somebody like Tony Blair when he's going on and on about, you know, how morality in Kosovo and all the rest of it's a moral, our moral imperatives and all the rest of it. So there's a deep belief in that. But then it gets projected into this particular geographical way. And what happens is, of course, the spaces of the world get demonized. They become, as it were, satanic territories that need somehow or other to be corrected. They need the force of American law. They need the force of American military might. They need to be helped to understand the ethical principles upon which the United States is founded. Certain notions of democracy, certain notions of property rights and capital accumulation. They need to do that. So that at this point, the notion that you can actually simply trot out the demonization of various spaces of the world almost instantaneously and get massive support from your population because there are evil people in Somalia or evil people in Chad or evil people in El Salvador or something like that, and the way they go about this is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, some of the sort of campaigns that came out around the Central American emergencies in the 1970s, 1980s. I mean, people had a map of sort of Central America and the United States, and they had Cuba red, and then El Salvador went red, and Nicaragua went red, and Guatemala went red, and then all of a sudden Mexico went red, and then, God help us, Texas went red. And you can't, I mean, this was kind of seen as a simple way to try to portray everybody this incredible threat which is coming at us, and therefore we have to go and arm the Contras, and we have to upset all of the revolutionary activities which are going on in Central America, and we have to do all those dastardly things we do through the CIA and all the rest of it. And get public support, because nobody knows anything much about Central America. The interesting thing was, at that time, almost everybody who knew anything about Central America, the religious groups and so on, all of them said some kind of social and political revolution is absolutely essential if you're going to deal with the problems in this part of the world. So their attitudes to this, but they were a minority, their attitudes to this were very different from the way in which the State Department orchestrated geographical understandings. Now, bearing this in mind, you can go further and to talk about the way in which geographical knowledge gets produced in various other areas. The tourism industry is great at producing certain kinds of geographical knowledges right now. Not only them, but you have all sorts of other, you know, the corporate cultures are producing geographical knowledges in a certain kind of way, and so you end up with a plurality of geographical knowledges which can get mobilized for very specific purposes. That is, the fragmentation serves a purpose. And the fragmentation of the geographical knowledges becomes terribly significant. And if you then start to talk about, and here you can use a Foucauldian argument about, you know, institutions and power and discourse formation and so on, and you say, well, how do the geographical discourses get formed by what institutions of power? Then you can look at how, for instance, the World Bank and the IMF has formed certain discourses about geographical difference, which are amenable to its own particular kinds of political and economic projects. And recently, of course, we've seen the peculiar event of many economists who are sort of following the World Bank a little bit and pushing the World Bank, kind of saying, oh, well, you know, geography matters. And one of the last issues of the World Bank sort of economic development report sort of has a big section on is geography destiny. And in it, there's this fantastic kind of stuff by Jeffrey Sachs at Harvard, who suddenly produces what is the equivalent of seventh grade geography in order to show that areas in the world that are really bedeviled by malaria have very little economic development. And that this is something, therefore, something incredibly significant. Well, of course, it is significant. But to discover it this late in the day, it's a bit like sort of a medieval historian after 100 years of sort of detailed research, discovering that the Black Plague had something to do with what was happening in the world at the time, and sort of then sort of trotting this out as a great finding. So here you have, as it were, the production of geographical knowledge is right now proceeding apace. But in these fragmented kinds of ways, which allow all kinds of political projects of all kinds to unfold in very specific kinds of ways. And what it allows, again and again and again, is discriminatory action in certain geographical, anthropological settings, discriminatory action, which is justified by some appeal to some sort of universal ethical code. Now, if that is the case, then why are we not seeking to put all of these knowledges back together again? That is, why are we not seeking to integrate those geographical knowledges into some sort of synthetic understanding which has a way and an ability to try to modify much of the social theory that we encounter and to reconstruct it? That is, can we rebuild into social theory serious principles, geographical principles, serious kinds of spatial principles, serious kinds of anthropological arguments? And I want to argue that, yes, we can. But it's going to take a lot of work, not simply by geographers, but almost like a sort of collaborative project in which much of that work gets pulled together from many disciplinary backgrounds. And that we somehow or other liberate those disciplinary backgrounds from many of their specific taskmasters. For instance, geographical knowledge got back into the university in very important ways. I've mentioned the way it's getting back via the economists. But if you look at international relations in the United States, and you look at the fields of international relations, you'll find a vast literature on geographical differentiation in the world, but it's all of it has built into it this idea and this ideal of U.S. in specific interests, and that therefore it is a construction of geographical knowledge from the perspective of those interests. And whenever somebody gets in there and starts making dissident remarks, you pretty soon get the message, no admittance here except on U.S. business. Keep out of here. And of course, historically, many of the dissident voices, I think of Owen Latimore as an example, many of the dissident voices have been silenced. And the silencing of many of those dissident voices over the years has, of course, led to many of the particular disasters of U.S. foreign policy, because they eliminated many of the people who actually knew what was going on the ground in various parts of the world. So, regenerating a critical approach to geographical knowledge then becomes, as it were, central to the launching of any alternative political project. Now, what I think we've been doing in rebuilding and re-emerging this kind of notion of cosmopolitanism is looking for an ethical code that can somehow or other work as a regulatory ideal in the current situation. And yes, indeed, I think it's fair to say that a regulatory ideal is desperately needed. But is it simply a regulatory ideal that is going to make that particular system of neoliberal development and capital accumulation and labor process work, all those kinds of things, is it simply going to make that a better regulated system, or is it absolutely going to be concerned to change it? And at this point, you find that different kinds of geographical knowledges become closely integrated with different kinds of cosmopolitan project. But you have to watch out, because there's something very peculiar about the geographical side of things. And I I want to mention this because it highlights some of the difficulty. And I'm quoting here from a very interesting historian of cartography, J.B. Harley, who wrote a very fascinating thing about the deconstruction of the map. And he commented that the ideological arrows have tended to fly largely in one direction, from the powerful to the weaker in society. The social history of cartographic and geographic knowledge exhibits few genuinely popular alternative or subversive modes of expression. Geographical knowledges have preeminently been languages of power, not of protest. Now that is, of course, the Foucault of Discipline and Punish. And at this point, it is very important to recognize the ways in which subtle geographical principles can actually imprison all kinds of political possibilities, and to recognize that geographical knowledges have to be reconstructed and have to be better understood in order to pursue certain political projects. Let me specifically make this argument around socialism and Marxism. As I suggested, socialism and Marxism have not been very sophisticated in their ways they've been handling the geographical kinds of problems. And when you see the sort of ways in which certain geographical events have erupted in ex-communist countries, you recognize that there was something sadly wrong in the way in which those sedimented banalities of neighborliness, many of the banal aspects of geographical understanding, were overlooked or regarded as trivial or irrelevant. And that therefore one of the ways in which a relaunching of any kind of socialist, Marxist alternative project must occur is precisely through a better grasp of those kinds of geographical, spatial, anthropological principles, which need to be elaborated upon as a specific kind of socialist project. See, geography is not just given, it's also made. It's imagined, it's reimagined, it's made, and it's remade. And one of the ways in which we need to rethink is to recognize that there's a certain dynamic to that process. And it's a dynamic that can have unintended consequences of all sorts. And that therefore the relaunching of any kind of alternative to capitalism as we now know it, and I would submit to you that we've got to do some very serious thinking about that, the relaunching of that project has to be thinking about the production of an alternative kind of geography. And the difficulty here, as Harley says, is that most of the geographical knowledge we have actually looks at the whole problem from the other direction. It's managerial. It's how the system can control things, how power can keep everything in its place. And a real revolutionary geography from the bottom becomes somewhat hard to construct for a variety of interesting reasons. It's there, of course. It's there with the anarchists like Reclus and Kropotkin, and you can find it in all sorts of other places too. But the geographical reconstructions that we're looking for have to be part of the process. And they have to be integral to the process, not just applications of the process. And the integral to the process also means that in the production of these geographies, we may be also having to think about not the production of homogeneity, but the production of geographical heterogeneity. That geographical difference and diversification should be one of the aims and objectives of any socialist project. And that the production of those differences, as were an exploratory medium for thinking about new geographies, the production of those differences must be, as it were, written into the very notion of what political action is going to be about. Now, there's a lot of thinking within geography and within those areas of knowledge which are concerned with spatiality, geography, and all the rest of it, which I think is beginning to address these sorts of questions. It means, to go back to Nussbaum, that indeed a cosmopolitan project is going to have to think about a significant revision in the way in which knowledge gets built and the way in which knowledge gets constructed. And that without that significant revision, we're going to end up with the same old story all over again of a sort of a cosmopolitan beauty of ethics and all the rest of it and the simple banality of evils on the ground. So let me give the last word to Kant, since I started with him. He put it this way. He said, "The revival of the science of geography should create that unity of knowledge without which all learning remains only piecework." That seems to me to be an important lesson, that the unity of knowledge is something which is possible, projectable, but it doesn't mean it gets homogenized. It means, in fact, that we have to integrate into it as the conditions of possibility of the construction of knowledge, as well as the conditions of possibility of the realization of knowledge in practical affairs, we have to put into it what Kant theoretically argued for, but was never able to do, which is a serious understanding of geography and of anthropology. With those two as a foundation, it seems to me we have a much better possibility of reconstructing those knowledges for all kinds of political purposes in the future. And this applies as much to neoliberals, third wayers, as it does to Marxists or socialists. It is, as it were, a mandatory condition for doing anything in a way that seems to me to be halfway successful in relationship to issues of environment, community, urbanization, geographical difference, and all the rest of it. So we should take Kant's ideas seriously, even while objecting most strongly to his geography. And I think that it is so interesting to observe that great thinkers like Kant, Foucault, and of course the whole discipline of economics and all the rest of it, they hit this question of spatiality and geography and so on, and they all back off. Well, it's time to stop backing off. I think it's time to confront what the Kantian conditions of possibility of knowledge are really all about. Thank you very much.
Well, we've got a bit of time for questions. I'm not sure if there's a... Is there a roving mic around the... Oh, there is, yeah. So, David, you want to pick who you want?
Yeah, okay,
to
yeah. Anybody want to... Over there.
So, you mentioned Kropotkin, and I've just read him recently, and just finished News from Nowhere, Morris. Any thoughts on... Yes. On that aspect? You're talking about the heterogeneity. It seems that in the
yes.
universality
yes.
seems...
Yes. Well, you know, one of the interesting things about the geography tradition is that insofar as there is a radical tradition within geography itself, it's been almost entirely anarchist. And that, I think, for very good reason, which is the anarchists, by and large, were much more sensitive to notions of locality and difference and the rest of it. And within the sort of... And then in the William Morris socialism, we also find that kind of sensitivity. And within the Marxian tradition, there are these figures also, like, of course, Raymond Williams, and eventually I would include myself, who are really trying, as it were, to be much more sensitive on these geographical issues. I think actually one of the bigger tragedies in terms of politics over the last 100 or so years has been precisely that split between the anarchists and the Marxists. And I think that there are many things that come out of the anarchist tradition which can be absolutely, you know, utilized in terms of getting a much better geographical handle on political questions, and many things out of the Marxist tradition which I think can be, as it were, deal with some of the other problems that arise specifically within the anarchist tradition. So I would not pretend that that's an easy road to move down, but I would want to say that, I have a lot of thoughts about rereading those people, and I've been rereading Reclus, who I think is really very interesting on this topic, and sort of, and at that time when Reclus was writing, that, the clean break between the anarchists and the Marxists had not really occurred, and there was a lot of discussion still going on between them, and I think that was a very fruitful time to think about some of the politics. So yeah, I have thoughts about them, and I think they're very interesting to go look at in this regard. But again, part of the problem there is, you go back and look historically at these characters, but I think what we have to deal with is right now the production of geographical knowledges in the here and now by, and the way in which, for example, new kinds of geographical knowledges are being reappropriated and reutilized in various disciplines for various kinds of purposes, and to ask some serious questions about, well, what's going on there? What will happen if Jeffrey Sachs sort of gets hold of the World Bank, which he might do, it's entirely possible. And what happens then with the kind of ways in which geographical knowledge will get manipulated? So I'd rather spend my time actually looking at the way in which institutions, current institutions, are manufacturing various geographical discourses for various purposes. Most of them not terribly benign, I have to say.
Say something on that.
Sure.
For me, in terms of development, if there is this argument for bottom up,
yes,
then it seems that, from what I've been reading, that though going back to the anarchists, they're the only ones that really seem to have an argument about the possibilities,
yes,
of people coming forward and going back for the project,
yes,
as opposed,
yes,
to the power base.
Well, the trouble probably offend some anarchists when I say this, but the trouble with the anarchist argument when it gets pushed to its limit is that it does tend to operate at a relatively small scale. And we have a lot of issues right now, like everything from global warming, ozone holes, coordination of labor relations in Indonesia and so on, which actually take a lot of almost global thinking, so that I would want to argue for a politics which is much more nuanced with respect to scale, which is both small scale and which is global and which has many layers in between, so that the question of scale starts to become very important. I mean, for instance, you can have very benign, wonderful-looking policies at the very local scale, but if you aggregate them all up to a regional or national scale, it may end up being fairly disastrous. A lot of anarchist proposals to start to think about bioregions and Murray Bookchin's decentralized municipalism, or is it municipal socialism? If you kind of say, look, would the United States be better off if we only had communities of 5 or 10,000 people? And if they were, if you dispersed all of New York City, would the place be benign ecologically? I'm not sure the answer is good on that. It may be that high-density, concentrated urban living is one of the ways of dealing with certain kinds of environmental questions. And so the anarchists are not very good at sort of thinking through some of the long-term implications of what they're doing. They also can, on occasion, get extremely exclusionary. That you're allowed to vote in a community once you've been there for 15 years or something. There's things like that which happen. So I think that the anarchists have a rich source of thinking about certain parts of the problem, but it needs to be put together in a different kind of way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
David, I'm very sympathetic to most of the arguments you've made this evening, which I find very convincing, with one exception. At one stage, you were talking about American policy or attitudes towards geographical education, or rather the lack of it, and you implied, it seemed to me, that there was almost a, and I insert this word deliberately, a functional policy on the part of the state to ensure that the majority of American citizens remained supremely and blithely ignorant of all important geographical facts. I would perhaps, without underestimating the power of the American state in many respects, I would suggest rather that it's perhaps that very geographical ignorance which forms rather a precondition of government ability to undertake many of the policies that they do.
Oh yeah, I don't disagree with that. It is. I don't think it's the power of the state that does it. By the way, I think it's. You see, my own university, just to give you an example of this educational policy, my own university, Johns Hopkins University, was the first president was a geographer. And as a geographer, he went to the University of Berlin to learn how to set up a research university in the United States. And the Johns Hopkins University was the first research university founded in the United States. And as a geographer, he'd read Alexander von Humboldt, but he'd also read a Frenchman called Alexander Guyot. And Alexander Guyot took almost entirely that sort of Kantian view, which said, the people in the tropics will never be able to think for themselves. It is the duty of people in temperate zones to develop the intelligence to put all of that human labor to work in a very specific kind of way. And the Johns Hopkins University was founded quite literally with that in mind. And much of the educational strategy was set up with that in mind. And of course, the one department they didn't have was a department of geography where that might be critical. They didn't have a department of anthropology, which might be critical. And it was only, interestingly, in World War II, when another geographer who happened to be president of the Johns Hopkins University, it was only in World War II, when that geographer said, well, it is in the national interest that we train officers in a certain kind of geography. And so we get a geography department, which is formed, and that geography department is specifically meant to sort of train officers in military affairs. So it doesn't arise through this power of the state in any kind of simple kind of sense, but you see an elite pattern of education which kind of says, elite population shall be trained in certain kinds of geographical principles, but we don't want these to be diffused widely. And I think you're exactly correct that this is that allows certain kinds of power structures to be maintained. And it goes back again to this notion of institutions forming discourses, which are discourses which preserve certain kinds of structures of power. So it is that circularity which I think is significant. And if I made it seem like it was just one way, then I think obviously I misspoke. It is in fact that sort of duality which is part of the problem. Somebody down here.
Sedimented banalities of neighborliness might, of course, strike one as one tremendous euphemism for nationalism, which was something that hit socialists very hard in 1914. Now, you spoke critically about the weakness of Marxist socialism in this respect, but, of course, there was a contemporary form of socialism that did have a geographical consciousness, that did have a geographical language, which was the language of power, which is National Socialism.
Yes.
Is there anything to be... No, let me rephrase the question. What, in your view, can be learned from the right-wing ideology in this respect?
From right-wing... Was this a... see. No, I think the... when you read that kind of... those kinds of materials, and the written version of this paper, by the way, I sort of also diverted into the question of Hannah Arendt and the banality of evil and what that had to do with Heidegger and Heidegger's views of, you know, sedimented, you know, sort of understandings of place and dwelling and all those kinds of questions, because that is also an important thread which slides through here. But you see, the sorts of examples that I think we need to look at much more closely right now, and I've been trying to read some of the literature, would be the intercommunal violence which is erupting in India, and not only there, but I mean, I also see it in Nigeria and elsewhere, and these kinds of things are not about. I mean, the point here is that this is not about nationalism in that old kind of sense. It is more, and why I like the term sedimented banalities of neighborliness is precisely that it just doesn't say the only issue here is nationalism. That in fact it is the simple question of local identifications and how those local identifications then get built upon and utilized, by the way, through a more macro kind of project, like the sort of Hindutva kind of movement in India. I mean, as a lot of it is actually sort of orchestrated through the banalities of those, that sort of sedimented banality side of things, and therefore it is not simply a grassroots thing that erupts from nowhere. It is something that is constantly in dialogue with some major political movement. I mean, you look at this in the United States, and you look at how the Christian right also mobilizes in very specific kinds of ways. It's not as if it's just a grassroots thing. It is something which has much more national presence. So I think they've finally probably screwed themselves by deciding that they want to ban all the Harry Potter books because they induce people to ideas about sorcery and witchcraft and idolatry and things like that, which I think they're probably, you know.
I'm afraid I think we've only got time for one more question because there's a reception after this. Maybe someone from upstairs would like to.
Yeah.
There's one.
Right, there's a mic up there. So.
I was really interested by what you said about geography and anthropology being something which should be studied before really getting a unity of knowledge and understanding things, kind of a key or a door through which to go. And I saw that as an understanding of man and his environment and understanding that kind of thing first. But wouldn't another approach, a very similar approach, be one of trying to understand the man and or a kind of psychological approach to the whole problem of finding a unity of knowledge?
Well, the two comments about that. In Kant's rendition of the argument, the anthropology at that time was essentially very much about psychology and inner understandings. I mean, Kant sort of differentiated between an outer study of human beings and a study of their inner states, and anthropology was not clearly separated from psychology at all at that time. And so that was one of the things that he had in mind. But let me make clear, I'm not making an argument that kind of says, look, you've got to go off and do your PhD in geography or anthropology or something like that before you can go on and do something else. No, it's a question of having the whole thing in some sort of dialogue, and that recognizing that there's no way in which we can avoid or evade questions of universality or generality or you know, we cannot do without some sort of cosmopolitan ethic of some kind, however temporary and however conjunctural. You know, we can't do without it. We desperately need it. But what we also need to do at the same time is to recognize that the way in which that plays out is through these specific geographical, anthropological kinds of differentiations, and that therefore keeping them in dialogue, keeping the universal in dialogue with the particular, recognizing that there's a dialectical relationship between the two, and that there is no particularity without universality, and there's no universality without particularities. You know, recognizing that is part of what it has to be about, and that therefore what we are seeking to do here is to reconstruct, as it were, knowledge around that sort of dialectic, rather than simply sort of saying, okay, you go off and do this block over here. I mean, I hope this audience doesn't think I'm specifically arguing for the discipline of geography. I actually don't care if geography disappears, provided that sociology disappears, anthropology disappears, economics disappears, and they all disappear, and we do something radically different. And I think that would be great. I think that's actually what's needed right now. But the whole kind of problematic that is set up right now is making it extremely difficult to do that. Everybody likes to preach it, but nobody actually wants to go off and do it. And it's very hard to do for precisely the sorts of reasons that come out from a study of this sort of peculiar history over the last 200 years. So, yeah, there are various ways to go. So there's various kinds of ways in which different findings from different fields can feed into this sort of, feed into these kinds of questions. I mean, I think evolutionary psychology, for all the problems that may be involved in it, you know, has some interesting things to teach us. All of the stuff that's going on in neurobiology and so on, maybe, you know, and all the stuff that's coming out in terms of the physical sciences and genetics and all those kinds of things are also important to look at. You know, I don't think there's a simple way to sort of say, well, the answer lies here rather than there. But it's trying to keep many of these issues in dialogue with each other, but recognizing that the condition of possibility of a lot of these knowledges does rest in a rather profound kind of understanding of anthropological, geographical questions, because those questions are really questions about who we are and what we are and how we might be. And I think the question of alternatives is thoroughly wrapped up with the question of, well, who might we be and what can we become? And those are the sorts of issues that it seems to me it's important to put upon the agenda right now.
Well, it seems a reasonable question to close on. Can I just remind everyone that there is a reception in the senior dining room to which everyone is invited, and maybe David would answer a few more questions personally there. Can I again thank him for his lecture tonight and say how good it is to have him around the LSE?